Good morning. The briefing today will tell you more about the circumstances in which an SAS trooper was tragically killed in action in Kabul on Friday night our time. I'll also use this opportunity to formally release his name. It is therefore my sad duty to advise you that SAS trooper Corporal Dougie Grant, paid the ultimate price and died trying to free hostages on Friday night. He was 41 years old and was from Linton. He leaves behind a loving wife and two young children, a daughter aged 7 and a son aged 5, as well as his wider family. His own family, his SAS and Army families, and all of those in the Defence Force deeply feel the loss of this man. On behalf of the Defence Force, I extend my heartfelt condolences to his family. Before moving on, I'm aware that some media had identified his name yesterday, and I wish to extend to them my thanks for respecting his family's request for space and privacy during this most difficult time. I'd now like to tell you a little bit more about the circumstances in which Corporal Grant died. The British Council office was the target of a terrorist raid. As we're all aware, this was the anniversary of the independence of Afghanistan from British rule. There had been some alert warnings about a possible raid, and therefore most of the city and the counter-terrorists, as well as the policing and wider military units, were on standby for some action to occur. There was no warning of what the target was, though. The British Council office was the target of an assault. Most of the media reporting over the last few days on the incident has been accurate, and it is not my intention to go into more details of the wider operation. What I will be talking about, though, is the operations in which our SAS were engaged, the specifics of those tasks, and in particular how Dougie Grant died. For those who wish, this is a Getty image, and it's been in the Herald. This is Doug Grant. And so there is the footage of him entering the operation. In a wider picture, the area that we were focusing on here. This is the compound. This is the main building in which the terrorists were holding up. The crisis response unit, the Afghan crisis response unit, was given the responsibility of attacking and killing the insurgents that were holding up in here. There were some UK nationals as well as some security staff that were still in the building. Once the operation had been underway for a while, it was realised that the Afghan forces needed to focus on countering the terrorists, and so our SAS were given the task of rescuing the hostages, of rescuing the civilians who were still in the building. So our SAS strike team was focusing on getting those people out of the building. Dougie Grant was involved in the group that was doing this task, and there were two major locations for our team. First of all, the strike group that was going to go into the building to rescue our people out was positioned around here, close to the building, but there was overwatch in terms of coordinating fire from a higher point in this area. Dougie Grant had moved back to the site to get better situational awareness into the high ground to see, to provide further information to those teams that were going in. This is the site that he was killed on. He climbed up onto the roof of the building and was in this location observing the enemy when he was struck by an enemy round. There has been some media speculation about what he was shot with, and often the term of a 50 caliber has been used. He was shot, as we know, by a rifle or a light machine gun round, so probably 7.62. Just for further information, if a 50 caliber round had killed him, it would have probably torn apart his body. This was a rifle or a light machine gun round. He was then evacuated by the medics through the hole, withdrawn from that area through the hole and evacuated out onto the street. There was also a little bit of speculation about when he died. In hindsight, we now know that he probably would never have recovered from those injuries. They were terminal. But as he was evacuated out, the medics who were with him were able to discern a pulse. At least once during the evacuation, he lost his pulse and was resuscitated. But when he was being placed on the helicopter, our understanding was that he still had a pulse. When he arrived at the Bagram Military Hospital, though, they had ceased to give him care as he had died en route. Where the speculation about whether he died on site or on the route is probably when they first lost a pulse, there was discussion about whether the medical evacuation should be cancelled. Our guys, who were adamant that he still had a pulse, insisted that the evacuation continued. But that's where the first reporting of him being killed in action came from. But our understanding and our medics state that they were pretty certain that they were reviving him. He still had a pulse. And at that stage, where they weren't able to verify exactly what the injuries were, their intention was to try and evacuate him back to a hospital. I think it does credit that our special forces and our military have world-class medics, and therefore the amount of support immediately at the time of his injury and throughout was world-class. And the hospital he was going back to in Bagram, again, is a world-class hospital with amazing facilities, that if there was a chance to revive him, that was his best chance. Probably at this stage it's useful for me to talk about the body armour, as again there's been speculation about whether the body armour was effective or not. It can be confirmed that Dougie Grant was killed by a bullet entering the side through his armpits, going through his body, through his heart and out the other side. One of the realities about modern battlefield protection equipment is that there's nothing we can do to protect ultimately protect someone. The body armour that we use is designed to protect the vital organs as much as we can. But the reality is, because of the functionality that they need and the mobility they need over the battlefield, it's impossible for us to fully protect someone. And so this armour is designed to protect the heart from most directions and the vital organs in the torso of the body. You will note that there is protection to the side, over the shoulder, as well as protection under here as much as possible, but with the range of movements you need to climb to fire a weapon, there are some spaces where weapons can go through. After this, you'll get a chance to pick up and feel how heavy that is and understand that to actually get more comprehensive body armour, you'll severely restrict their ability to actually operate on the battlefield, and they'll become more vulnerable by not being able to move, not being able to climb, not being able to take up fire positions. This is not the exact model that the Special Forces use. They have a slightly upgraded version which is more able for them to move, but it actually shows the same layout that their armour has. So from the start, we are confident that the equipment that we have, in terms of the personal protection gear, the body armour, the helmets, the other protection systems that we have for our people, are top world class. And it was just the reality of the battlefield environment that he was caught by someone firing from his side, and it went through, collecting his heart on the way out. I'll now move on to Corporal Grant and his history in the Defence Force as well as the Special Forces. Corporal Grant was a long-serving member of the Defence Force, 21 years and extensive experience. He spent a third of his career as an infantryman in the New Zealand Army and a further third with the Royal New Zealand Engineers. The remainder was with the SAS, and this was the era where he actually had the most personal identity with. He had extensive operational experience, two tours in East Timor, one in the former Yugoslavia, as well as a previous tour in Afghanistan. It was his second deployment to Afghanistan with the SAS, and he had only just recently returned to Afghanistan with a rotation. The SAS, as we all know, is one of our premier combat units, probably the premier combat unit that we have, and is certainly world-class, as shown by the operations in Afghanistan over the last few months. It requires extreme mental and physical ability and stamina to make the grade. Only about 10 to 15% of all those who apply to join the SAS go all the way through the recruitment and training process. The work is always dangerous, and they're brave men who do their best to serve New Zealand and do their best to accomplish the mission. They are an extremely tight-knit group, and because of the nature of what they do, they're grieving, but they also have enormous self-discipline and self-confidence in each other. Their very tightness and the special tactics they use, of course, do mean that they need to be a group that's kept private and kept away from the public eye. The tactics and techniques they use, we try and keep out of the public eye, because we don't want terrorists or their opponents being able to learn from their own tactics. And as we've seen in the tactics in Afghanistan by the terrorist groups, they do watch and they do observe. So we need to be vigilant that any advantage that they can gain out of media release needs to be minimised. Dunk served in the SAS as well as the engineers and infantry with pride and commitment. He was widely regarded as a competent and likeable person in the SAS, and as I mentioned before, he saw this as his identity. He had left the unit and gone down to Linton, where his family are currently are, but he eventually decided that he wanted to go back into the unit because that's how he saw himself, as being an SAS soldier from the start and the finish. Along with the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence, I visited his family on Saturday to express our heartfelt sympathy. I've made a commitment to them that we will do everything we can to care for and support them throughout this time and beyond. The family have made a media statement, and I'll be sending it out to you after this, and I'll now read the statement from the family. The family wish to acknowledge and express their appreciation for the support they have received from the New Zealand Army. Doug had a wide group of friends from all walks of life. The support and love from all these people has been humbling. Some might wonder why Doug went into harm's way. Doug had absolute faith in his friends and colleagues and what he was doing in Afghanistan. He understood what he was getting into and believed in the goal of training local forces for that country's future. He was a determined person, some might say stubborn in his pursuit of his goals while growing up. He wrote in a school essay once that he wanted to be in the SAS. He worked towards that goal from that time onwards and convinced the army he could do the job. Like most Kiwis, Doug did not make a big deal about his achievements. He shied away from the spotlight, preferring to focus his attentions on his family and getting whatever job he tackled done to the best of his considerable abilities, whether it was building a house, being a soldier, or being a husband and father. The family is incredibly proud of Doug's achievement as a soldier and as a husband, father, brother and son. Doug was adamant in his determination to keep his work life separate from his family life, and we appreciate that while he is now the focus of our country, that the media give Tina and the children some private space to come to terms with the fact that he died doing one of the things he loved. The family have requested that Corporal Grant be brought home as quickly as possible. He's therefore returning home on a commercial flight. Just be aware this is slightly different to the information we gave out in our first brief, where there was still speculation and options about how he might be brought home. We'll keep you advised on the details of the repatriation and funeral arrangements once these have been confirmed. At this stage, it's proposed to hold a private commemoration for him in Auckland, and then he'll be transferred in a more formal ceremony down to Linton Military Camp, where he will lie in state for a few days. This will be followed by a service at Linton Camp, again the date to be advised, but please note that the service itself will be closed to the media. And we're working with the family to make the arrangements in accordance with their wishes, and our goal from the very start, as it is now, is to ensure that the family is supported and their wishes are met. To conclude, this is the reality of military life. Every soldier, sailor and airman knows the dangers which they will go into, be it in the air, at sea or on land. The reality of military life is also that those who are left behind need to close ranks and move on, need to have the hard, steady face to continue to face the tasks and the difficulties that we have. I wish to give my thanks to those people in Afghanistan who remain on duty. I also wish to give my thanks to those people who have rallied round his family and have been with Tina right from the start. And I also wish to give my greater condolences to his family, to those who were his friends, and to those who were his comrades who still serve. I now ask the Minister to make a comment. Thank you.
As Minister of Defence, I wish to pay my personal condolences to Corporal Douglas Grant and his family. As a Member of Parliament and as Minister of Defence, I am conscious that whenever young New Zealanders are deployed overseas, that this is the risk that we ask them to take. And on this particular occasion, the highest price has been paid, and fundamentally it is actually paid by his family. So my condolences go particularly to his family. But as you've heard from General Jones, our Defence Force, our SAS in particular, are resourceful, they're resilient and they're resolute, and they will carry out our nation's tasks that we set for them. On this particular occasion, Corporal Grant was actually protecting and saving lives of the British Council people, and for that I believe we should all be grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I'll now give the opportunity for questions.
The
SAS were sorry, let me just go back again. The Crisis Response Unit was deployed to support or to take on the role of entering the building and killing the terrorists or neutralising the terrorists. Initially, a British regular unit had deployed to cordon off the area. The Crisis Response Unit, with our mentoring team with them, was deployed in. Once it was identified that it was going to be quite a complex attack, it was a very hardened building, then our team were brought in because of the division of responsibilities. Whereas the Crisis Response Unit was focused on the terrorists, they needed another group, another brick, to be able to rescue out those civilians who were still in here. So it was quite some time after the initial deployment that our team was assigned its task and moved in.
So it wasn't indeed at that point to clarify.
No, we had a subsidiary mission to get the civilians out, the exact number we weren't sure of, whereas the lead was the Crisis Response Unit that was focused on the terrorists.
Who makes that decision?
The local commander on the spot, which was an Afghani.
So how did you respond to criticism then that the SAS is supposed to be mentoring, but they end up in these lead roles if you move to the regulations of yourself after the intercontinental
It's always been identified that the mentoring and training role for the Crisis Response Unit would involve them going with them on operations, but the lead for them is gradually being handed over to the Crisis Response Unit. So it had always been mentioned quite a while ago. John Key made the comment that they weren't there to eat their lunch. They actually were shouldering those responsibilities. But in terms of mentoring and leading, what they do is they train them how to do it in the training back in their base camp. But on operations, I'll go with them and support the Afghani commanders in their decision-making, providing advice to it. But it's the Afghanis who are taking the bulk of the operational lead, the firefighters, through. There are still occasions where there is a difference, where if we leave them to it, it will take a lot longer to complete the missions. They are certainly not near the standard of our own SAS, and therefore, in order to speed up to reduce casualties, there is always the desire, there is always the ability for us to step in and help, rather than it being bogged down and risk further casualties to civilians or bystanders or our own side. And that's always been an understanding of what the SAS were doing. But their prime role is to train and then go with them to assist the Afghanis do their job.
Is the SAS's role becoming more dangerous as the Taliban changes tactics?
Afghanistan is always a dangerous place and always has been. The tactics really brings back into the spotlight the Kabul and the spectacular events that we've seen over this last year. So those tactics do bring the need to have the Crisis Response Unit up to a high level. It does possibly accentuate the fact that we're right in the very centre of attention in here, but it also shows that high quality, world class units like our SAS are what's needed. Yes, other people could do those jobs, but the fact that we are one of the best in the world means that we can be relied upon. The experience and the training that has been given to the Afghanis is going to be the best there is available. And the prime focus is training up that Crisis Response Unit to do their task. This operation, as well as the ones over the last month, have shown that they are stepping up quite well. As they become more proficient, the probability and likelihood of us being directly engaged will drop off. But the terrorists will continue to adapt and change their tactics, and so we need to continually have the possibility of our forces being deployed in there as unusual things will occur. But again, that comes back to the emphasis that we want to minimise the knowledge of our tactics and techniques and procedures. We want to keep one step ahead of them as we can, and therefore having quality units like the SAS available to ISAF and the Afghan government becomes important.
Can you confirm that the bullets that killed Grant came from an insurgent?
Yes, we can.
And And was he one of the insurgents who was killed by the CIU?
Yes.
Did you know that?
I probably had met him. I didn't know him individually. I had met his wife before as well, when she was a medic. But I did not know Doug to a great extent.
She still serves in the army in some capacity?
Yes, she does.
What does she do?
She is in the Education Corps, previously a medic, but went into the Education Corps.
41 years of age, two young kids. Is there any indication that this would be his last deployment? Had he looked at moving on to anything else?
He had moved out of the SAS on the reality that his wanted to focus on his family, but he was in the SAS with his young kids. But there had been a lot of discussion in his family about him wanting to go back into the SAS. So he had asked to come back into the unit, knowing that the probability of further deployments was on the cards. So they had made the family decision to move for him to come back into the SAS, and under the understanding that this would not be his last minute.
How would you describe this event and
The terrorist tactics are changing from a broad insurgency across the population to a more high visibility, more spectacular events. We consider the reason for this is they were losing the battle out in the countryside. The leadership had been stripped out by the tactics we were using, the concept of operations about how to target insurgency, which is isolating the people from the insurgents and taking away their logistic and their command skills. They've had to change their tactics to focus more on high, spectacular events, more targeted at the media profile this has outside Afghanistan. Their target, very similar to insurgents in the past, is to alienate the populations of those people who are serving, or those countries that are serving in Afghanistan, to remove the confidence that the ISAF forces, the Afghanis, are starting to regain control of their own country.
Any gallantry awards picked up along the way of this? Yes,
not that I'm aware of. At this stage, while we're still going through our operational debrief, it's too early to tell. But all of the circumstances they're in require bravery. They are under fire, as you can see, and so the level of engagement, the level of danger in, it's highly likely that it's some citations, some recommendations will come, but we're still at the early stage.
Will he be replaced in Kabul?
His replacement is already underway.
Does he need to review the withdrawal date of next April?
No, there is not. When we deploy our soldiers overseas, we intend to carry out our missions. And as the Prime Minister said on Saturday, New Zealanders don't cut and run. So our deployment is through to March next year. The Prime Minister has also been very clear on that. We have no intention to extend that deployment. They will have been there, in fact, 2.5 years at that point, relatively small unit, and it is really time for them to regroup. And of course, as General Jones has indicated, we are there to actually build the capacity of the Afghan government. They, at the end of the day, are going to be responsible for their security, and that we're in essentially in that process of transition now. Transition really is taking place from now through to 2014, and certainly all the briefings I've had would indicate that the crisis response unit is building its capability all the time. And that was evident on this mission. We've had both General Jones and myself and the Prime Minister have had that direct statement from the Director of Special Forces in New Zealand.
Have you seen evidence that, in fact, by leaving a reduced force, you have increased the danger that you're operating
in? That's probably a tactical question.
Yes. The smaller size forces that we have here can still do the prime job, which is to train and support the crisis response unit. They are able to, the reduction mainly reduces the ability to do consecutive or sequential operations where we're doing two or more things at the same time or in fast succession to each other. So in terms of reducing their ability to do the role, no. The forces there are adequate to continue the training and focus on the crisis response unit skills.
Would this be the normal number of troops that you would send to an operation like this, knowing what sort of firefight they're getting themselves into?
Yes.
So you wouldn't send any more than that if you had a
visit? No, the crisis response unit was able to focus. about 100 people were engaged in this operation, most of those in the cordon or support troops going outside, medical support, communications. The strike unit out of the crisis response unit was focused on the terrorist and going through into the building, and our small team was designed to do a particular mission or could have taken on a more specific task should the situation get further out of hand, but focusing on getting those civilians out of the building was an appropriate task for a unit that size.
Is it your expectation that another commander may take over the EGS's role with the
unit remaining next year? Yes, the crisis response unit still needs mentoring to further enhance their capability. Every force, even our own force, trains with other militaries overseas, other special forces to raise capabilities. And so the partnering of the crisis response unit will continue.
And just in terms of the repatriation of staff, my understanding when Lieutenant O'Donnell was repatriated, there was problems bringing him back into the country, and a memorandum of understanding would occur between customs, MAC and Defence Force. Is that something you're anticipating this time?
Yes, this is now the third person we've brought back out of Afghanistan, and so our processes are reasonably well known to bring them back into the country. The exact mechanism of how to bring them back and the time that takes is the detail that we work through about availability of military flights, availability of support, but in this particular case, bringing him back at the earliest opportunity was the family's desires, and that narrowed us down into a civilian liner. And of course the bringing back of bodies through a civilian system is a well-oiled machine from NFAT's point of view.
Just a clarification on the photo, the KI location, he was the only one up there, and is that him in that photo?
No, that's not him in the photo. He was not the only one up in that area. There are other people providing the overwatch.
Sorry, the only SAS member?
No, he was. There are other people up there providing overwatch, as well as the a medical person in that area. I can also emphasise, again, there was the crisis response unit, the Afghan unit, also had one person killed in the building and one other seriously injured, as well as eight lightly injured as well. So those were the friendly force casualties that were occurred. Four terrorists were killed in the building, and probably another two who were in the vehicle that blasted its way in there, and there are a number of other casualties. At this stage, I have no further information over and above what you have about the other casualties. Three British and two Gurkha security guards.
I know you said that the SAS had to come back and regroup, but can you rule out that they might go back to Afghanistan?
The Prime Minister has made it very clear that the deployment is through to March.
But you can't rule out that they might go back after that?
Well, the Prime Minister has made it very clear the deployment is through to March.
What do you do for the family? You were saying earlier that you're looking after the family, obviously you've visited the family and expressed your condolences, and that you're looking after the future, that sort of thing as well. Two young children, obviously a widow now. So what does the NZPF actually do in regards to their well-being in the future after this?
Well, let me just step through what they do from the immediate crisis. Probably useful for information of you. We will always notify the family ourselves rather than the police doing it, and those people who go and notify the family will then remain with them for the next week or up until the time of the service, and as far beyond that as the family wishes. So we have people from Linton Camp, but also the special forces with the family to provide the support and the liaison with the military. So they are there to talk through what we've talked to you through here. This is what happened in the event. This is what's going to occur. Here's information about the repatriation. A lot of the friends out of Linton Camp are also with them, the personal friends of Tina, the wife, as well as friends of Dougie have come through and are providing constant support for them. What we provide is, I suppose, certainty and reliability and assuredness during that time when they are focusing on themselves. Their grief means that they cannot make a lot of decisions, and so that support we provide in terms of turning the military machine on to provide the ceremonial support, the evacuation, take away from the family all the burdens about organising the funeral, about what happens afterwards. Those are the things we provide in immediate support. In the longer term, we provide, it depends on the family circumstances and what they want to do. In this particular case, where Tina is in the military, the ongoing support for her, because she will remain part of the military community, will always be there for her. She will get, there are some compensatory payments, insurance payments that the Defence Force underwrites and pays for that, as well as the support if they then choose to leave or shift or move to anywhere in New Zealand. Those benefits or that support still is entitled to by the family.
Any more questions?
So once again, thank you for coming here today, and once again I do really thank you for giving the family space. It is not easy for a family at any time, but I do appreciate the space you've given. Thank you.